Hi, this is Daniel Garber, the movies for CulturalMani.com and CIUT 89.5 FM. Art can be beautiful, shocking, moving, or novel. It can function as a historical record or signal future changes in how we view the world. But it has never been a commodity, an investment, a future, or a stock to be leveraged. That is, until its steadily rising value proved irresistible to investors, many of whom know the price of everything, but the value of nothing. The Price of Everything is the title of a fascinating new documentary that takes us behind the scenes of the monetary side of fine art. It talks with curators, collectors, historians, critics, dealers, and auctioneers, the people trying to determine the perceived value of a work of art and maybe to influence its value. And the movie talks to artists themselves who embrace or reject the long game of fine art. It's written and directed by Academy Award nominated American filmmaker Nathaniel Kahn, best known for My Architect, The Price of Everything, played at Hot Docs and is opening today in Toronto. And I'm very pleased to have Nathaniel Kahn via telephone to tell us more about The Price of Everything. Hi, Nathaniel.
Hi.
Thanks so much for agreeing to this. I realize this is being taped during Thanksgiving Day, so thanks for taking time away from the turkey.
Yes, but I'm very, very thankful for having the film being released in Canada. That's terrific. That's a great way to spend part of Thanksgiving.
Excellent. So, Nathaniel, just last week, a painting by David Hockney, one of his swimming pool paintings, sold for $90 million, a record for a painting by a living artist. It's a beautiful work of art, but how can a painting that's just a few decades old be worth $90 million?
Well, that's part of why we made the film. The producers and I were very sort of fascinated by this idea that, art has always had a long relationship with money. Art and money have always been connected. That's not a new thing. But we were fascinated by this kind of recent phenomenon, which is the extreme commoditization of art. And of course, as always, art holds a mirror up to our society and our culture. And we have become a society and culture that is obsessed with money and with the price of things. And one of the reasons we wanted to make the film is really to distinguish between the price of something and its value. They're not the same thing. And, works of art, ultimately their greatest value is in their power to communicate and to express what is within the things that, as one of the wonderful characters in the film said, one of the wonderful interviewees in the film says, we used to live in a time when values like the soul is what we really cared about. Well, I like to think we still care about those things, but these days, in a world that is so intensely commodified, sometimes the true value of something, the deep value of something, the soul value of something, gets lost in its financial price. And words like value get devalued and become synonymous only with the monetary value of something, which of course is in the end not the greatest value of anything. But we live in a world that is obsessed with those things at this time.
Well, in the old days, traditionally, professional artists, they partly made the art to express themselves, art for art's sake. Of course, they would have a rich or royal patron, but otherwise, they didn't expect fame or fortune during their lifetime. But your film talks about something that happened in the 1970s, something called the Skull Auction that turned the art world mm-hmm. upside down. Could you talk about this?
Well, sure. I mean, I think, artists, I'm not sure if I agree with you there. I think artists have always wanted to be known in their lifetime, of course. I mean, you live in a certain time. You're not only thinking about the future, you're thinking about your own time. And I think artists are fundamentally driven by a desire to express feelings that are within, but they're also driven by wanting to engage with their time and to communicate their feelings about their time with the people around them. But it's true that artists in general, people don't go into being an artist for the money. I mean, that certainly has not been the that's not generally the artist's way. Artists are driven by something else. Right. In 1973, the producers and I were very interested in trying to identify moments of inflection, moments when this commodified world that we live in today found its origin. And one can find a number of those moments, but certainly a very key one occurred in 1973 when a taxi fleet owner named Robert Scull, who was a collector of contemporary art, he knew the artists, he was the backer of a gallery, he bought directly out of artist studios, when he put his collection of 50 paintings, and he had more than that, but he put 50 of his paintings up for auction at Park Burnett Gallery, which was, it's now Sotheby's, but it was called Park Burnett then. And he put this art, primarily by living artists, up for an auction. And the surprising result was that he found that, in fact, there was a big market for art by living artists. And that was generally not the case in the so-called secondary market, which is the auction market. We have some remarkable footage, which we restored, and we worked with a filmmaker who'd actually made a film about the Scull auction, and we restored some of that footage, which captures this remarkable historical moment, in which, for the first time, art by living artists was auctioned, you know, at a major sale, and the returns were surprising to everybody around. People said, "Oh my gosh, art by living artists can be taken to auction and can make a real profit." So that kind of kicked off it's a little bit slow motion because that was 1973, and you know, here we are in 2018. So, but it's been a fairly steady growth since that time, with a few real jumps in the last, you know, in the last decade or so, where we now see that the auction market for fine art is really dominated largely by contemporary art, by art by living artists. And on a certain level, that's kind of an exciting phenomenon. But it's also terrifying, because suddenly the market and the powers of the market and the gears of the market that churn along begin to affect every aspect of art making. One might be inclined to think, okay, well, that's a great thing. There's more market for artists. But the reality is that most artists do not really participate in this very high-end auction scene. It's a somewhat rarefied world, and it's dominated by not that many names, really. A lot of the money that is being made in that very high-end world is dominated by not that many artists. And so it's very difficult today for an artist to block a lot of that out. And you have to, as an artist. I mean, one of the things we address in the film is that to be an artist in the contemporary world, one has to stay close to one's muse, to the things that are the voices that are within that you must be in contact with to be an artist. So when you're constantly kind of surrounded by all of this noise that comes from the market, it can be extremely difficult as an artist to keep doing your work and not think about that. Because the moment you start letting those things in, then you're in the position of having to say, okay, well, you know, this thing sold before, maybe I should keep making some of those. Or, I'm not doing very, look at all these other people who are doing so much better than me. Should I keep going? These are things that I think for the artist, those are distractions that the artist must block out. So in speaking to artists in this film, we contend with some of those questions, and it was very fascinating to speak to artists in many different sort of areas of the art world and art market, and discuss with them how they deal with those forces.
Well, one person.
One of the key characters is Larry Poons, and perhaps you were going to mention him.
Yeah, so I was interested in both Larry Poons and Jeff Koons, who sort of are the polar opposite of one another, which path
sure.
they take.
Yes.
So you can go
well,
on for that.
One wants contrast in a film, And there are many contrasts in this film. In fact, I think one of the reasons that audiences enjoy the film, and certainly why we enjoyed making it, was that we found many, many contrasts. Society is, you know, is filled with contrasts, and so is our film. And one sees amongst the artists that there are very strong contrasts.
Well, I wonder if you
they
could
make
talk
different
about
kinds of art. Sure,
I wonder if you
know,
could
artists. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, could you talk about, because it's quite revealing for the film goer to see the internal workings of the studio where Jeff Koons churns out large quantities, almost like a factory, of his newest art product.
Well, you know, one of the qualities of the film is that we are not here to judge
right
one way of working over another way of working. So Jeff Koons' studio indeed does have a lot of assistance helping to make his work. That in and of itself is not unusual in the sense that even an artist like Rubens, you know, had a large studio with many people working in it. So
that's
the
true
idea that an artist has helpers, or Rodin's studio had many helpers, you know, that in and of itself is not so unusual. I think that what one begins to see in looking at Jeff Koons and, say, Larry Koons, who is the names rhyme, but they're certainly very different in many ways. In looking at the difference between them, you see the difference in ways of making art. Jeff has many people who are working on his works, and he is able to turn out a very large volume of work, which, of course, does suit the market and the marketplace. It's very good for the marketplace to have you know, a lot of so-called product, a lot of art. Larry Koons, on the other hand, makes everything himself, which is a little bit more the kind of the traditional vision that we have of an artist. A lonely cold studio, working by himself or herself, and sort of driven by these internal thoughts. So seeing Larry work on one of his magnificent, enormous canvases, and the interesting thing, one of the things we really wanted to do in the film was to show artists working. And it's such a privilege to be in an artist studio, but it's also kind of a rare thing to be allowed in an artist studio while they're working. So we have sequences of the artists working in the film, and one of them certainly is Larry working on one of his enormous canvases. And he strings a 60-foot piece of canvas around the entire studio, and he works on the whole thing all at the same time, which is, you know, beautiful to watch and fascinating and visually stunning and really fun to film. But you see sort of this contrast of the lone individual, you know, facing the blank canvas. In his upstate studio, far off the grid, far away from the madding crowd of New York. And then you see Jeff Koons' workplace, which is, you know, filled with people working on multiple pieces all at the same time amidst the bustling metropolis of New York. And that contrast is certainly a very strong one, and one that that I think gives the film, you know, a great deal of interest, and one of its key contrasting quality.
And finally, just a very short answer, maybe 20 seconds. Do you think the art world is a bubble?
Well, I'm not here to make financial prognostications. So,
right.
So, you know, I can't tell you if it's a bubble or not, but I can certainly tell you that I think the art world reflects our current fascination with all things monetary. But ultimately, as the film's title reminds us, the price of things is not the same as the value of things. And that's something we very, very much wanted to bring up in this film and explore.
Thanks so much for talking with me. Nathaniel Kahn's new documentary, The Price of Everything, opens today in Toronto at the Rogers Hot Dog Cinema. This is Daniel Garber, the movies each Friday morning on CIUT 89.5 FM and on my website, culturalmining.com.